Hello and welcome to the Mile End Institute podcast, coming to you from our secure bunker at Queen Mary University of London. I'm Robert Saunders, and today we'll be making a journey into Brexit land. That's the title of a new book by the political scientists Maria Soblewska and Robert Ford. Its full title is Brexit Land: Identity, Diversity, and the Reshaping of British Politics. And it offers a compelling account not just of Brexit, but of all the great tectonic forces of the last decade, from the rise of Scottish nationalism and the transformation of the Labour Party, to the growth of identity politics and the recasting of conservatism. Gary Gibbon of Channel 4 News has called it the new political Bible of our times. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Rob and Maria to discuss their book. Can I start by asking you, Maria, how you came to write the book and what questions you were trying to answer?
The story of this book is really predates Brexit. And this is, I think, why we cast such a wide net to explain Brexit, because Rob and I have been discussing the issues around the change of the British electorate for quite a while. And we have been particularly focusing on how does Labour manage to bridge the new divides in British politics, and can they survive as a political party? And so when Brexit did happen after the referendum, this was really thrown into sharp relief, what kind of pressures the Labour Party was facing and how all political parties adapted to this change. And so we started this book to try to go back to the origins of our conversation and so really start talking about those big changes in British politics that have started happening way before Brexit referendum was on the books. And so this book really tells the story that treats Brexit and the referendum itself as a kind of moment of awakening rather than a bona fide change in British politics. It is a change, but it's only a change insofar that people realize that these changes that already have been happening for decades have actually been taking place.
And was there a sense there, Rob, that you were trying to challenge some of the arguments that were already emerging? Because it seems to me that one of the more curious features of the Brexit phenomenon is that most people were surprised by Brexit when it happens, but very quickly decided that it vindicated what they already believed about the state of British politics and British society.
That's very true. We were keen to challenge some of the early accounts that tended to do what accounts of British politics very frequently do, which is to focus in particular on the issue of social class. There is a tendency to sort of think that everything in British politics is about class. And what's really obvious when you look at the data on EU referendum vote choices and the political identities that emerged afterwards is that they're really not very much to do with class. They're to do with education, they're to do with social identity, and they're to do with social values. And it's those latter things that are the reason that once Brexit had happened, once the vote had happened, people immediately saw this as aligning with their viewpoints on politics. Because what was happening, as Maria mentioned, was an awakening process, a mobilization process. People already had very different worldviews based on whether or not they went to university, based on whether or not they had a worldview that was focused on national identity and threats from outsiders, or whether or not they had a more cosmopolitan outlook. But Brexit gave them a kind of banner to rally under that didn't exist before. So the voters on each side of the debate understood pretty quickly what Leave and Remain meant to them as political identities. The people who didn't seem to understand this as well were the people who commentate on politics for a living, because they reached for the tools that they have traditionally used to explain political phenomena and talked about this in terms of class and inequality. And really, it's a very different kind of divide.
One of the things that I really liked about the book, reading it as a historian, is that you set Brexit in a much longer historical perspective. That this is a book that really begins in the 1950s and 60s, and you lay out a series of long-term changes in the electorate, which helped to create the conditions for Brexit. So, Maria, could you sum up for us how you see the electorate as changing in the decades before Brexit?
So we focus in the book on two big social changes. One of them is education, and it's the huge expansion of higher education in particular. When we start in the 50s and 60s, the proportion of British people who have gone to university is in single digits. By the time we have finished writing this book in the spring of 2019, in that particular cohort, 50%, for the first time in history, 50% of that cohort of kids turning 18 has gone to university. This is an enormous change that has happened basically within one lifetime. And the second change that overlapped historically, but also overlaps because of the kind of effects that it has on the British population, is the rise of ethnic diversity. Again, within one single lifetime, we have gone from a society where, yes, there are people of non-white minority origins, especially from the previous British colonies, which at the time, of course, are still colonies, go through a society that experiences a huge change from this kind of tiny pockets of presence to quite widespread across the country, and especially in cities that have become super diverse often, with a huge mixture of languages, ethnic origins, cultures, and different religions. And so we have gone through a change where a kid born in the UK in the 50s might never encounter a person of a different race and might never go to university. And we fast forward 50 years and 60 years, and we go to a society where kids are much more likely to go to university, but also much more likely to live amongst people who are different from themselves. And these two social changes matter because they produce a very similar value change. In those generations, growing up without diversity and without higher education, and the generations that grow up with both higher education as a given and ethnic diversity, the latter generations have a very different outlook on life and on Britain than the previous generations.
So to take the first of those two changes, I was really struck by what you had to say in the book about how the rise in university education transforms the whole worldview of a section of the electorate. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that. Why should going to university or not going to university become such a big political divide? Why should people who come to Manchester or Queen Mary in London to study chemistry or engineering seemingly come away with such a distinct set of attitudes towards things like immigration or race?
We believe what gets captured in the kind of demographic variable, you know, university graduate, is a whole package of different shaping experiences. We've known since the time of Karl Mannheim that, you know, the period from about the age of 16 to the early 20s is the period when people's values and worldviews are most malleable. And that's also the period when they attend university. And one source of value change that university attendance produces is simple direct exposure to different viewpoints, different backgrounds. Our universities are based in big cities. Their intakes are socially and ethnically diverse. So the people who are going to university are moving to new places and meeting people with a variety of views. There is also a curriculum effect, quote unquote, in that at university, people learn things that challenge their existing perceptions and worldviews. And of course, that will vary from subject. You'll probably hear more stuff that challenges your personal values on a sociology course than on a physics course. But there is a general exposure effect. And there is evidence that this is quite robust. People have done very careful statistical modelling to look at graduates and non-graduates, people who are otherwise identical in their worldviews before they went to university, and then looked at them again, say 10 years after they left university, and they diverge, particularly on these identity issues and social issues, issues of race, issues of national identity, issues of attachment to the in-group and threat from the out-group. Graduates and non-graduates really do seem to diverge. And so as the graduate share of the population goes up, you end up with a situation that you have two groups in the population that have very, very different views on this cluster of issues that moves to the centre of politics. And of course, it's not just here that we see this at work. Whether or not one attends university is the strongest predictor of support for radical right anti-immigration politics in basically every European country. And whether or not one attends university is also the strongest predictor in the white American population of whether or not people support Joe Biden or Donald Trump in the ongoing presidential election.
That's fascinating. And of course, there are voices on the right, both in Britain and America, that see university education as a kind of political problem and that want to reform the curriculum that want to perhaps change the kinds of messages that are conveyed at university. Do you think we're likely to see more of that sort of project, and could that reshape politics in the future?
I think this is a very interesting question, because simultaneously universities change the kind of values that people possess, but also the universities are changing the kinds of elites that we are getting. One of the trends that we are documenting in the book is not a social trend so much as a political trend, and that trend is towards recruiting of our political elites from a very similar narrow social background. So actually we are talking about right-wing parties as well as left-wing parties recruiting from the professional backgrounds, from university graduates themselves. And this produces a very interesting gap between the kinds of values that our representatives, political representatives, hold themselves personally, and the kinds of values that they are trying to reflect in terms of their own electorate. And this is coming back to this original point of our project, which was to do with the Labour Party. And what we have found is that the Labour Party has, before Brexit, had a much bigger gap on those values. Generally speaking, the Labour Party MPs and political candidates were very liberal and were very, almost universally university-educated, middle-class professionals, but they were trying to represent very working-class constituencies where few ended up going to university. They were all extremely comfortable with diversity, and in fact, an ideology of anti-racism was something they have wholeheartedly signed up for, and yet they were often trying to represent seats where BNP was doing really well in local elections, where the anti-immigrant sentiment was running high. And so I think this kind of instinct of going against university education is going to be a problem for MPs that almost universally draw from that very population that has gone to university, that has benefited from university education. And I think now what we are going to see is that kind of value gap on the conservative benches as well, whose values are very different to the values of the population they will be aiming to represent.
And you present a really striking shift here from a time when both major parties were really competing for school leavers, people without university education, and in a sense all politics happened on their terrain, to one in which we have these warring tribes pitted against one another. And you talk about identity conservatives on the one hand and identity liberals on the other. Could you explain what you mean by those terms?
Essentially, that's a kind of broad brush thumbnail caricature we try to use in order to summarise the big kind of cleavage in outlook. So identity liberals constitutes two groups. It's white university graduates, particularly in younger generations, for whom social liberalism in general and anti-racism in particular are core political and social values. These are things that they want to see more action on in politics and in society. And alongside them, ethnic minority voters, many of whom are in fact quite socially conservative on many measures, many of whom express quite strong attachments to their own identity groups, their own social groups, but who are aligned with white graduate identity liberals for a somewhat different reason, which is essentially group interest. Because if you have a situation where prejudice and feelings of threat from outgroups are mobilized into politics, these groups know from direct experience that they are the groups that are likely to be on the receiving end of that kind of mobilized hostility in the white electorate. So therefore, they align with identity liberals to combat that. And then on the other side of the coin, you have identity conservatives, which is essentially older white voters who left school at the earliest opportunity. And these are voters who tend to have a very strong attachment to a rather narrowly drawn set of social in-groups. They tend to be rather nationalistic. They tend to be inherently opposed to immigration. They tend to be more likely to express negative views of ethnic minority groups and feelings of threat from ethnic minority groups. And they are the group who have been repeatedly mobilized by, in particular, the Conservative Party historically, but more recently by UKIP, over issues like immigration and latterly Europe and race in the Powell era, because those feelings of threat and anxiety and a desire to protect the in-group are really powerful motives for them.
You also, I think, describe those identity conservative voters in the book as ethnocentric. And I wonder whether that's a term that might raise a few hackles among some Brexit voters. So could you say something about what you mean by that term and why you chose it?
So ethnocentrism is a very old term, and it was first used at the turn of the previous century by ethnographers in America. And it was a term describing how human beings organize themselves, both emotionally and socially, into groups. And it was used to explain anything from cultural traditions that we perpetuate and why we perpetuate them. And it was to do with this sense of organizing ourselves into us and into them. So the us are the people who we liked and we associated with. We valued that association, that identity, and we did certain things to keep up that us identity, like engaging in a specific traditions, passing on songs from generation to generation, celebrating certain holidays. Whereas the them was perceived as a threat. So anyone who would fall outside of the inner group, the group you identified with, was regarded with some suspicion. And there is plenty of research about how this is a very ingrained human tendency to think about us and them in this way, to worry about them being different and potentially threatening the us that we value, threatening our traditions, threatening our maybe even resources like food and land availability. And so when we think about this ethnocentrism as a tendency, what we can see is that, yes, it is extremely natural. And in fact, probably everybody has it to an extent. What makes it an interesting thing to explore in a context of identity politics is that people differ in terms of how much of a threat they feel when faced with the them, and also how broadly they define the us. So what we have found looking at the British population using the available survey data was that people, for example, who were university educated, they didn't find the them so threatening. And immigration is a great example. Even though people generally thought in the middle of the 2000s that there were too many immigrants, they really did differ on whether they thought immigration was universally bad for Britain or good for Britain. And especially on the question of, is immigration good for British culture or does it threaten British culture? We saw a real difference there. And this is pretty much what we are talking about when we talk about ethnocentrism. Do you feel threatened? Does immigration or any kind of external focus on otherness bring in you that sense of threat? And I think another thing that is really worth underlining here is that immigration is almost an accident of history, in a sense, in a way that it has activated this threat. It doesn't have to be immigration. It could be any other us versus them issue. So here, looking forward, it could be one of the social issues. It could be something to do with how we define gender, for example, that might increase that sense of threat amongst ethnocentric voters. But also another thing that is worth pointing out here, and one of the reasons why we used ethnocentrism rather than just attitudes towards immigration, for example, is that attitudes towards immigration can wane. Whereas that tendency towards thinking in terms of very narrow us and very threatening them is something that's very stable. So people who have that tendency, as I said, can get triggered by other social and political issues as well. They have that tendency, and whether that tendency is activated or not is the question, rather than whether they have that point of view or not.
So as you've suggested, these are deeply ingrained tendencies, but they are activated or triggered at particular points in time. And in the book, you present a sort of foreshadowing of our recent political moment in the 1960s and 70s with Enoch Powell and the issue of Commonwealth immigration. Could you tell us a little bit more about that and about why you see this as such an interesting precursor to our recent situation?
This was actually something I first discovered many years ago in my original PhD research, which is that if you look at the very first British election studies in the mid-1960s, you find that voters already are expressing very high levels of opposition to Commonwealth immigration, remarkably high levels of opposition, given that the levels of migration were really not very high at that point. but there's no kind of political outlet for it because they regard both parties as essentially moderately pro-immigration. And then the moment that Enoch Powell arrives on the scene, that political picture is transformed overnight, even though Ted Heath, the Conservative leader at the time, immediately dismisses Powell from the shadow cabinet. Incidentally, this is an example of identity liberal social norms in action, because Heath was told by other cabinet colleagues if he didn't dismiss Powell, they would resign because they were appalled by Powell's comments. So clearly what he was saying was regarded as a violation of anti-racism norms by conservative political elites who all went to university. Amongst the population, though, a large majority supported what Powell said and then began to apply Powell's statements to the Conservative Party, assuming that they represented Conservative policy. So even though Heath had fired Powell, voters went with Powell and assumed that what Powell was saying represented what the Conservatives would do. So what you had was an ethnocentric electorate that from the beginning regarded immigrants from the Commonwealth as a threat, as a them. You then had a politician willing to mobilize that threat using the language of ethnocentrism, using the language of us against them. I mean, there are a few starker statements of the ethnocentric worldview in British politics than Powell's speeches on immigration. And as soon as those statements are made, these ethnocentric voters mobilise en masse behind the party that that politician represents, even though he is not representing the party's policy. If you then look at voters' views of conservative immigration policy in 1970 and 1974, they assume that what Powell is saying represents what the Conservatives will do. Then in 1979, Margaret Thatcher also makes a quite ethnocentric, albeit much milder statement when she says that people are worried about British culture being swamped by that of migrants coming to the country, and that they have every right to expect governments to solve problems that they worry about. That again was an appeal to ethnocentric feelings of threat, and that again produced a very strong alignment between these ethnocentric voters and the Conservative Party. And then after that era of the 1970s, that alignment is visible in the data all the way through until the time of the coalition, when it begins to fall apart in reaction to the failure of Cameron's pledges on immigration. So it's really, like Brexit, a story of awakening and mobilisation, and one that had lasting and often underestimated effects, because whenever immigration became an issue that voters worried about, they would instinctively gravitate towards the party of Powell and Thatcher, because that was the party they expected to address the threat.
And I thought that analogy with Powellism was particularly interesting, and it really chimed actually with some of my own recent research. If you look at right-wing attitudes towards the Commonwealth in the 1960s, it's striking that they attacked the Commonwealth in almost exactly the same language that would later be used against the EU. The idea that the Commonwealth was a bunch of ungrateful foreigners who took Britain's money, told it what it could and couldn't do, and flooded it with immigrants, while at the same time you had a governing consensus that was willing to accept higher levels of immigration as a kind of trade-off for global influence. But you suggest, I think, in the book that governments were able to ultimately to respond to concerns about Commonwealth immigration in a way that they couldn't do later on with EU immigration. Why was that?
So when we look at the British involvement in the Commonwealth, what we see is that initially the immigration from those countries was enabled by the fact that they weren't in fact legally any different from the British people who were born and lived in Britain. So when Commonwealth immigration starts, people have equal status. They are subjects of the British Crown. And such a thing as British citizenship simply doesn't exist. The concept of British citizenship was introduced very much to differentiate people for whom it was a birthright to be in this country and for whom it wasn't. It's very telling here. It was already a very identity politics exercise in describing who counts as us and who is a them in this context. So we have politicians who have this instinctive need and desire to include British Commonwealth territories in the us, not just for historical reasons at this point, not just for the reasons of, oh, British Empire has been a great thing for Britain, but actually also because of the fallout of the Second World War. this political elite has been fighting a political ideology that wanted to differentiate people on the basis of race and on the basis of otherness. And so this does explain a lot of the elite consensus around trying to be open as possible, and certainly not limiting access to Britain on the basis of race for a very long time, and well beyond, in fact, what the public opinion was dictating at the time, because public opinion was very hostile from almost the very beginning. So what we see is a series of policy reforms to this concept of British citizenship, which becomes increasingly more narrow and finally does focus in of this notion of patriality, which is a notion of ethnic entitlement to being allowed to settle in Britain and live in Britain. And it is a roundabout way to go about racial exclusion, but it is in practice delivering racial exclusion, because it is a concept that says that somebody whose origins come from Britain, so one of your grandparents had to be born in Britain. And this, of course, gives priority to the colonies that have been settled by the white British people. So New Zealand, Australia, these post-colonial subjects were much more likely to be then admitted back into Britain because they had the white ancestry in British Isles, whereas the Commonwealth countries that were predominantly not white would lose that right to settle in Britain. But again, when you look at the documentation, the public opinion polls that we present in the book, this reform clearly lags behind the public opinion. So the public opinion always is much more hostile and pushes for that reform for a long time. So the public not only wanted a collar bar on the British citizenship, but also wanted a very extensive program of repatriation, for example. And the political elites have never really gone in for that level of reform. But they have ultimately followed in on the collar bar preference of the British public. Whereas when we fast forward a few decades and we are talking about the EU, this is no longer possible. Without leaving the EU, we cannot undermine the principles of the freedom of movement for work within the EU. And so the promises that the Conservative Party is making in terms of limiting immigration to the tens of thousands are basically impossible to deliver. And therefore, there is this big gamble that Cameron makes, and ultimately this is the death of him, is that he thinks that he can go back to the EU and basically blackmail them with possible British exit to try to create this kind of exemption. But as we know from history already, this has been the one gambit that has failed him.
So as you say, if we fast forward to the 1990s and the 2000s, we have what perhaps looks like a potential Powellite moment again, in that there's an increasingly discontented body of culturally conservative, non-university educated voters feeling increasingly distant from a liberal governing class, which is unable to do the kind of things to tackle immigration that it was able to do in the 1970s. So why didn't that drive a much bigger body of support for a party like the BNP?
That is where historical legacies become very important, because the moment that this starts to become activated in the electorate in terms of ethnocentric voters saying immigration control is the thing I want to see our political system deliver in large numbers is the early 2000s. So pretty much most of the decade of the 2000s, you see more than a quarter of the electorate naming immigration control as their number one political priority. But as you know, we don't see a takeoff for a kind of Powellite party at that point. And why is that? Well, the reason is because when you ask those voters which party they expect to deliver immigration control, they are still at that point saying that the Conservatives, who are in opposition at this point, are the ones who will deliver immigration control. It is no accident that in 2005 and then again in 2010, we see the Conservatives very much emphasising the issue of immigration control. They can read the same polling the rest of us can read, and they could see that in both of those elections, and indeed in the election of 2001, immigration was the issue on which they had the biggest lead over the incumbent Labour government. So there was no need at that point for a Powellite party, because the voters who were most attracted to a Powellite party still thought the Conservatives were, in this respect, a Powellite party, that when they got into government, they would deliver immigration control. And as Maria mentioned, this is where the great Cameron Gambit goes horribly sour, because he makes, in his classic kind of offhand casual way, this promise of, oh, we'll reduce immigration to the net tens of thousands. I don't think that's too much to ask. Failing to realise that what he had just pledged to deliver was completely impossible to deliver within the policy framework of the European Union, given that migration from the poorer, newer members of the European Union was now one of the main sources of migrant inflow. And that created what I think in the book we describe as a kind of masochistic ritual that began as soon as the Conservatives entered government in 2010. Every quarter, the Office for National Statistics would produce new migration statistics. Every quarter, those would show migration running way above the Conservatives' pledge. And every quarter, the ethnocentric anti-migration right-wing press would attack this and say, you are threatened by this, you want this controlled, they are failing to control it. And the other remarkable thing about this is at no point in that period of, say, 2010 to 2012, do Cameron or his Home Secretary Theresa May come clean with the public and say, I'm afraid this pledge is not deliverable within the EU, and we think staying in the EU is the right thing to do. They just keep promising that it'll be different next time, and it never is. And as a result, Cameron and May managed to burn through 40 years of accumulated Conservative advantage on the issue of immigration in 2 years. And that then opens the door for a power-light anti-immigration party, which duly arrives in the form of UKIP, a party that didn't actually begin as a sort of strongly anti-immigration movement, but instead a strongly anti-EU movement. But this was the perfect moment for them, because they could say credibly to ethnocentric voters, if you want immigration controlled, we have to leave the EU. They could link those two issues together in a way that was intuitive and that was, broadly speaking, actually correct as well. And every quarter, the truth of what they were saying would be reinforced by these new migration statistics that would show once again that the Conservatives were failing. So that's why it's at that moment, say 2012 to 14, that we see the takeoff of an anti-immigration, radical right, ethnocentric party rather than 10 or 15 years earlier.
So that takes us to the parliament that ran from 2010 to 2015. And that period in many ways seems to be the crucial period of your book, the moment perhaps when the iceberg that's been slowly melting for decades crashes down into the sea. And you've talked us through one of the big changes there, which is the collapse in the Conservative Party's reputation on immigration. But could you talk us through some of the other big shifts that you see happening in the electorate or in the support base of the various parties over that parliament?
The second big thing that we see in this parliament is a change in the, and this is quite a significant, really a sea change in the kinds of people that support the Labour Party. And one of the crucial moments in 2010 is, of course, that the Liberal Democrats decide to go into coalition government with the Conservative Party. The Liberal Democrats have been traditionally this party of quite a mixed support. So there have been quite a lot of social liberals that were attracted to this party, a lot of people who were quite left-wing but lived in constituencies where Labour Party historically wouldn't stand the chance, and therefore they were voting on a kind of anti-conservative platform there. But also it was a protest party, and this was a party that actually mopped up a lot of people who just didn't like any of the two main parties. And so when the Liberal Democrats collapse, and their support collapses because they have gone into coalition with one of those two big parties that their voters didn't like, what happens is almost a quiet, but as I said, extremely significant change in the support of the other parties. And Labour in particular, this is something that is really appreciated, that in that period, Labour experiences an outflux of all those ethnocentric voters who now have UKIP to turn to. They wouldn't want to vote Conservative, but they can and do turn to UKIP. And of course, the influx of some of those Liberal Democrat voters who have voted for the Liberal Democrats because they were very socially liberal and quite left-wing. And so what we see is that the Labour Party goes from a party that has had a vast majority of the supporters were, in fact, working-class supporters, left-wing supporters. They go through an electorate change, and that electorate that they end up with afterwards is an electorate that is predominantly liberal. It is no longer an electorate that is predominantly working-class. It is an electorate predominantly of white, university-educated, and ethnic minority liberals. And what we see here is the kind of sea change of this support that doesn't translate into any immediate electoral advantage.
Yes, it's interesting that the name Jeremy Corbyn doesn't feature very much in the book, partly because this isn't a book about principally about political actors. But it did seem to me that you have a very compelling account here, both of why the Labour Party embraced Jeremy Corbyn after 2015 and why some of its traditional electoral heartlands did.
Yes, it's true. In many respects, the conditions for Corbyn were kind of set up, the ground was prepared by his predecessor, Ed Miliband, because that was the period in which the Labour electoral coalition shifts decisively in an identity liberal direction. And that shift is even more evident amongst the Labour membership base, which has always skewed more towards university graduates and social liberals anyway. So when Corbyn arrives on the scene with his highly cosmopolitan, anti-racist, socially liberal message, it's that side of Corbynism, I think, that was particularly appealing to this new and distinct Labour electorate rather than necessarily his economic radicalism. Although, you know, for many of these voters, those two things can go together, but it's the social liberalism that's uppermost for a lot of these voters. But of course, it's that very feature that also puts him most at odds with the traditional Labour voters. Because as Maria mentioned, by 2015, Labour is already becoming a majority identity liberal party. But the problem that poses for Labour is history and geography. Labour is still receiving a lot of its MPs, a lot of its votes from seats that have Labour cultures stretching back a century, but where those Labour cultures are in fact very socially conservative and very working class. They're kind of legacy Labour cultures, legacy Labour seats. And from 2015 onwards, particularly after Corbyn, Labour become under increasing pressure in those seats. And again, the seats don't fall immediately because historical legacies can take a while to erode away. I like the iceberg image you mentioned very much, and that's very much how it went in a lot of these seats. You can see substantial erosion in Labour support in each election, even going back sometimes to 2005 in many of these seats. But because the starting point of the Conservatives who start to win these voters is so low, it takes them several election cycles before they're even competitive, and then a lot of election cycles before 2019 when we finally get to the point when they go over the line. But again, this is an example of how commentators who focus only on the last election result and on the leaders in charge, you know, when the iceberg fell, are kind of missing the point. Corbynism accelerated these trends, but Corbynism didn't generate these trends. And Corbyn and his approach to politics are not the only factor that has led to those seats falling. Many of them probably would have fallen within a cycle or two, regardless of who was leading the Labour Party.
Some readers might be surprised that the global financial crisis doesn't feature more prominently in your account. Do you think that we've exaggerated the political effects of the crash?
We have spent actually a lot of time talking about this, and we have decided that no book can do it all, and our book is about those identity divides. So, of course, the global financial crisis is a very important and significant influence in British politics, and especially in 2010, when the Conservative Party finally manages to a change of government after the consecutive Labour government. But the truth is that because we already saw in those public opinion polls the increasingly worried electorate, increasingly worried about immigration, a part of me thinks that we would have seen a change in government anyway, to some extent. I think, and this is a kind of a problem of what-ifery in politics, but the truth is that the financial crisis, I think, momentarily took place and displaced the conversations about immigration. We see a small dip in the number of people who say immigration is the most important thing in around 2008 and 9 and 10. But the truth is that really everything is going in the same direction, which is Labour is losing ground. And whether it would have been the issue of immigration and that revolt on the right fueled by anti-immigrant mobilization, or whether it was the financial crisis, probably power would have changed hands anyway.
So drawing all of this together, it's time, I think, for the big question. How does all of this help us to understand the Brexit vote in 2016?
I think the very broad brush summary I would give is we need to understand the Brexit vote as the activation and mobilisation of new divides that have been building in our electorate for many decades, but have not taken centre stage, have not been the lead actors in the political conflict prior to this. They've been supporting actors. What was unique about Brexit and what made Brexit uniquely disruptive is that with Brexit, ethnocentrism, nationalism, university attendance, age, these become the primary things that divide leavers from remainers. These become the primary dividing lines. And then these get forged into social identities. As Maria mentioned in one of her earlier answers, one of the really critical things about this is political self-awareness as well. Before Brexit, people who now call themselves unprompted leavers and remainers and attach tremendous meaning, social meaning, to those terms. People have a clear idea in their heads who a leaver is, who a remainer is, what they think about various issues. So the referendum mobilised these things, but then had this lasting impact because now when people are thinking about politics in terms of the clash of interests and the clash of groups, they have these two new deeply ingrained, emotionally powerful, chronically available tribes in their heads to think about. And those tribal allegiances cut across the traditional allegiances that they have used to think about politics in terms of. So you have in the Red Wall seats voters saying, I'm a leaver and Labour is just for remainers. You have voters in conservative, traditional suburbia saying, I'm a remainer and the Tories are just all for leavers now. And so that's what produces this resonant and continuing disruption, because now that those identities are there, now that this moment of awakening has arrived, there's this sort of entrenching of those divisions in the electorate. In a way that wasn't true before. So you can't, in a sense, put the Brexit genie back into the bottle. Getting Brexit done, international relations terms, won't get Brexit done in electoral terms, because there's no going back to the political world that we had before Brexit.
We've been talking so far principally about England, but I thought one of the most interesting parts of the book was about Scotland. To what extent could we tell the same demographic story about Scotland in terms of university education, the divide between liberals and ethnocentrists, a rejection of the political establishment, but producing completely different political outcomes?
So we look at Scotland in the book very much to highlight this theme of our book, which is to do with social change taking place, but not dictating political outcomes in a way that some people who subscribe to the demography is destiny, a trope would have people believe. What we use Scotland for is to highlight that, in fact, the same demographic trends took place in Scotland. Yes, to a slightly smaller extent, particularly in terms of ethnic diversity, but we do also see a huge increase in the proportion of people who go to university. We do see a huge increase in the proportion of people who are born outside Scotland and who are of different ethnic and racial backgrounds as well. And what we also see in Scotland is that the same proportion of Scottish residents, of Scots, are ethnocentric. What we do see, however, and this is a crucial difference that does deliver those differential outcomes for Scotland, is that in their tendency of the ethnocentric voters to think in terms of us and them, the us and the them are very differently defined to what we see in England. And the principal difference is that the us are the Scots, and therefore the them is not Europe, it's not immigrants. The them, the threatening other, is in fact the English. And this is hugely consequential. Historically, when we look at the opposition to Englishness and the kind of support for Scottish independence and Scotland's unique national sense of belonging, what we see that because it was formulating itself during the Thatcher era, what we see is that it is linked with a kind of ideology of being more open-minded, more left-wing than the English Thatcher Westminster. The kind of conceptual cluster of the other becomes the right-wing Thatcherite. And therefore, it is not just a rejection of the English rule. It is also a rejection of a certain political way of thinking, a political ideology, so to say. So when we look at who thinks they are more Scottish than British, and when we look at who supported the leaving of the United Kingdom, it is much less kind of linked to the dislike of immigrants and that kind of what we saw here in Brexit in England. We see this almost self-perpetuating myth of Scotland being more left-wing, for example. It is not that Scotland is more left-wing. It is the fact that the association between nationalism and being left-wing is very different in Scotland. The Scottish nationalism is a political project that has inbuilt that opposition towards the legacy of Thatcherism, and therefore it has inbuilt that sense of very self-conscious openness, liberalism, and left-wing ideology. And so what we see is a social change that is very much parallel, but a different political rendering of that ethnocentric tendency and of that ethnocentric identity conflict.
Well, perhaps just to bring this to a close, you say at the start of the text that you're not pessimists, and yet the forces you describe in this book could be read as pointing to a politics of division and polarisation that cuts really deeply into people's political identities, and it could be very difficult to change. So what should readers be optimistic about when they put down your book at the end?
I think there are two main kind of slightly optimistic takeouts from the book. The first one is that even though Brexit obviously is a story of division and how we arrived at it, there's always a point where politicians can make a big difference, where the politics can start mobilizing people on issues other than identity divisions, and perhaps mobilizing also on the positive side of identity divisions. This is the one opportunity that Brexit has created, is that the story of the 2000s and 2010s really is a story of mobilization on the right, the revolt on the right, as Rob's previous book was titled. But what Brexit is doing is Brexit has offered a chance to mobilize on the identity liberal side as well. And this is a second point to be very optimistic about, is that our society, despite these divisions, the division doesn't come from the fact that on the right we have no increase in tolerance and that on the right people are becoming less tolerant. In fact, everybody in our society is becoming more tolerant towards others, variously defined, but certainly towards others defined on the basis of race. The division comes from the fact that the speed of this liberalization is very different. So on the most liberal end of the spectrum, with the most diverse and highly educated people, especially elites, what we see is a very fast change in how people think about those issues. And even though the people who are on the more ethnocentric end of the spectrum, the identity conservatives, they are also changing, they're also becoming more liberal, but that pace of change is much slower. And so to an extent, that division and that conflict is not about the direction of change. It is about the speed of that change. And we do have a chapter in the book about social norms that both of these sides employ to kind of try to defend their position where they are. But one of the big things that we have learned from this chapter is that social norm of anti-racism, for example, is almost universally agreed on nowadays in Britain. So the conflict over what is racism rages on, and some people have much more expansive definitions than others, but pretty much all of British population agrees that being a racist is a bad thing and agrees that we shouldn't be racist. And that is a huge cause of optimism.
Well, it's always good to end on an optimistic note. So Maria Soblewska and Rob Ford, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the Mile End Institute podcast. So thank you for giving up your time to come in today. Brexit Land, Identity, Diversity and the Reshaping of British Politics is published by Cambridge University Press. It's available in all good bookshops, including the ones that pay taxes. And it really is fascinating reading for anybody who wants to understand the politics of the last decade. So thank you to both of our guests. Thank you to all of you for tuning in. Please do subscribe to the Mile End Institute podcast for future episodes. And don't forget that you can sign up to our mailing list for information about future events. You can also find the Mile End Institute on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram and Twitter. Our producer is Sophia Cassano. I'm Robert Saunders. And that was the Mile End Institute podcast.